We have another question here. Yes. All right. The question is, the harder you try to change, the worse it gets. Is there a passivity there? Remember I said, the more you resist something, the greater power you give to it. So resist not evil. When someone strikes you on the right cheek, offer him your left as well. You always empower the demon you fight. That's very oriental. Flow with the enemy, and you overcome the enemy. How does one cope with evil? Not by fighting it, but by understanding it. In understanding, it disappears. How does one cope with darkness? Not with one's fists. You don't chase darkness out of the room with a broom. You turn on the light. But the more you fight darkness, the more real it becomes to you, and the more you exhaust yourself. But when you turn on the light of awareness, it melts. Watch this. Scrap of paper. This is a billion-dollar check. I must renounce it. The Gospels say I must renounce it. Got to renounce it. Got to give it up. I want eternal life. Substitute one greed with another greed. Huh? Spiritual greed with the other greed. Before, you had a worldly ego. Now you got a spiritual ego. But you got an ego all the same. Kind of a refined one. More difficult to cope with. I got to get rid of it. So I'm giving it up. I'm really giving it up. But something in me is drawing me towards it. When you renounce something, you're tied to it. But if instead of renouncing it, I look at it, I say, hey, this isn't a $1 million check. This is a scrap of paper. Lost interest. Gone. Nothing to fight. Nothing to renounce. Or if I look under it and I say, heavens, look at the anxiety under this. Look at the pain. Look at the depressions that are going to follow. I don't want this. Give it up. Understanding, awareness. Does that address itself to your question? Don't fight. Don't make efforts. Don't drag yourself somewhere. Find out what's going on. Like, if somebody has no appetite for food, and you force the kid to eat, come on, eat. No, no, no. What's called for is understanding. What's going on? Now, you have no appetite for happiness. You have no appetite for giving up your drug or whatever. What's going on? The violence will not change you. It might change your behavior. That's what I meant. But I have much more to say about it as we go along. About what does change really entail? How does meditation, how does understanding, how does awareness bring it about? Now, during these days, certainly this would apply to quite a few of you, you have understood something or other about what's going on in you. And you've experienced some little change, have you? Some little change, some little insight. I'm going to show you how insight, awareness, understanding produces easy change. There's no residue of violence. If you call in the army and suppress the citizens of a city, there's going to be a mutiny, and you're going to invest a lot of force to keep them down. So it isn't violence and effort that's called for. Who else? Yes. All right. She doesn't understand what is real and what is unreal. Look, in my country, lots of men grow up with the belief that women are chattel. I married her. She's my possession. Now, this guy walks up to you and says, that's real. Women are things. What would your response be? Not true, right? Depends, she says. You don't agree with him. If he's married to you, she says, oh, he's married to me, then it's not real. It's not true. That's interesting. That's a good one. She says if he was married to her, she'd be a widow. Isn't that great? That's terrific. Okay. Yes. Now, is this guy to blame? Get ready for a shock. He isn't. He isn't. Just like many Americans are not to blame for the way they're viewing Russians, they're not to blame. They just got dyed in a certain color, and there they are, and that's the color through which they're looking at the world, and they see that color. Now, what does it mean to make him real? To make him aware that he's looking at the world through colored glasses. Ah, there is salvation. There's no other salvation. Because I could say to him, stop it, that's not good. But till he has seen, he's always in danger of finding some other way of acting according to this conviction that was given to him. So I told you that's the making of the terrorist. He's absolutely convinced. He sees a real world out there. He's got real enemies. He's got people who hate him. But when we look at it, we say, funny, that's not there at all. You're imagining things. You're conditioned. So the great search of spirituality, the great task of spirituality, where am I coming from? Is this real? Or am I conditioned? Am I brainwashed? My dears, to doubt is infinitely more important than to adore. To question is so much more important than to believe. And it's because we don't do this that we have people killing one another. The readiness, the openness to question everything. The readiness to doubt everything. Doubt, says a great Indian mystic, is a healing balm. Though it burn at first, it will heal you. It begins to burn because when those convictions that you've introjected, are beginning to wear off, you feel as if you're losing your whole life. My gosh, I've been a communist all my life. I was seeing the world through communist eyes. Has it ever struck you that if you are thinking as a communist, you've ceased to think? If you're thinking as a communist, you've ceased to think. Does that make sense? How about if you're thinking as a Muslim? Same thing. As soon as you're thinking as anything, you stop thinking. As soon as you're looking at the world through an ideology, but what is an ideology? Those are words. Those are theories. Those are ideas and concepts. No reality fits an ideology. And all good ideologues will tell you that. They'll say, well, this is the best we've come up with. Doesn't fit. Life is beyond that. That is why people are always searching for a meaning to life. Has it never struck you that life has no meaning? Cannot have meaning. What is meaning? Meaning is a formula. Meaning is something that makes sense to the mind. But every time you've made sense out of reality, you bump into something that destroys it all. And you say, well, God is a mystery. Life is a mystery. We don't really understand it. We don't really know. It's like the mystics graft meaning onto their experience of reality. But it is really only a graft. Falteringly, inadequately, they try to express something. They give some clue, they give an indication. As I'll tell you when we talk about the scriptures, they tell you a story, hoping you'll get a clue. But it's not contained in that formula. It goes beyond the formula. Meaning is only found when you go beyond meaning. Life only makes sense when you perceive it as mystery, and it makes no sense to the conceptualizing mind. Yes, you have a question. Meaning is a set of sentences that your mind can understand. Label, very well put. Yes. Can what? Oh, I didn't say adoration wasn't important. I just said that doubt was infinitely more important than adoration. Everywhere people are searching for objects to adore, I don't find people awake enough to question themselves, their attitudes, their convictions. I'll tell you this, how happy we would be if a number of those terrorists would adore less and question more. How about that? Ah, now you're getting what I'm saying. Only we don't like to apply it to ourselves. We think we're all right. The terrorists are wrong. You know something? The guy who's a terrorist for you is a martyr for the other party. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm trying to filter through. People meet people.
Aloneness. Aloneness. Loneliness is you're missing people. Aloneness is you're enjoying yourself. Remember that quip of Bernard Shaw? When they asked him whether they saw him at a party. You know those awful things that you call cocktail parties where nothing is said. And I just don't see how people enjoy that, but evidently some do. So he found himself at one of these parties and they said, "Are you enjoying yourself?" And Bernard Shaw said, "It's the only thing I'm enjoying here." Right. So aloneness is when you enjoy yourself and, hey, listen to this, and others. Because you know something? You never enjoy others really when you are enslaved to them. Needing people means needing them emotionally. Community is not formed by a set of slaves. People enslaved to people. People demanding that other people make them happy. Go on, you're supposed to make me happy because my happiness is in you. Go on, you're not supposed to be moody now because if you're moody, you affect me. Change your mood. I need you. Community is formed by emperors and princesses. You're an emperor. You're not a beggar. You're a princess. You're not a beggar. There's no begging bowl there. You're enjoying yourself and reality. And so you enjoy everybody because there's no clinging, there's no anxiety, there's no fear, there's no hangover, there's no possessiveness. There are no demands. Free people form community, not slaves. Now, to my mind, this is such a simple truth, but you're so right there, it has been drowned out by a whole culture, including a religious culture. Religious culture can be very manipulative if you don't watch out. There was another hand up here somewhere. Yes. All right. Now let me reword your question for you or your comment, and you check me out. See if it's all right. She says, to my mind, awareness is a kind of the high point, the plateau. Until I get there, I want to experience every moment as it is. Now, first of all, don't make a goal out of awareness. There's nowhere to go. There's nothing to achieve. How do I get to this awareness? Through awareness. Now, when you say you really want to experience every moment, you're really talking awareness. Because you don't want to experience this guy. It's a friend of mine who's just gone to Ireland. He tells me, he's an American citizen. He said, "I'm entitled to an Irish passport, so I'm getting one because I'm scared to travel abroad now on an American passport. You know, I don't want a terrorist walking in and say, 'Let me have a look at that passport of yours.'" He says, "Well, I'm Irish. I fought oppressors too," says this guy. Well, you don't want to sit next to this guy on a plane and see an Irishman or an American. You don't want to see labels. You want to taste and experience this person as he is. And you want to do that with everything. Unprejudiced. You don't just want to taste your words. How many people spend their lives not eating food? They're eating the menu. They really are. Can you imagine somebody saying, reading the menu and says, beefsteak, there it is. No, for heaven's sake, wait a minute. That's only an indication of something that's available. So you want to eat the steak, not the words. That's awareness. That's awareness. All right. Your dependence. Now, as you become aware of that, as you watch that, disidentify and watch that. And as I'm going to tell you presently, don't condemn yourself. You're only going to make it worse. But if you would see the pain it brings you, you'll drop it. Mm-mm. You're quite right. You want the pain. You want the pain of having it. And you're angry with the pain. How wonderful. Now, I'm going to ask you a personal question. Have you spent 500 hours watching this? That would work out to an hour a day for over a year. Oh, the book is useless. No, I'm talking about watching this. Have you spent hours watching this? Two. You'll see miracles happening. Famous American therapist who said that. Get out, lose your mind and come to your senses. Yes, lose your mind and come to your senses. But now take that with a pinch of salt, huh? Because you need an intelligent mind to understand. It's not as if mere sense awareness is going to heal you of everything. If you're still keeping your programming, you're still keeping your conditioning, if you still think your wife is a thing and not a person, if you still think that you're looking at reality objectively when you're looking at it distortedly, well, just coming to your senses may not be all that much of a help. Certainly a help. But one needs intelligence to understand too. Awareness isn't a tool. Awareness is a method. Awareness is the goal. Awareness is life. One cannot misuse awareness. One is aware. One cannot... How does one misuse? Non-misuse. Be aware. Be aware. No one will tell you that the unaware life is preferable to the aware life. Be open to feedback. Be open to questioning. To be open, to be sensitive, to be aware. One cannot misuse that. Can one be fully human without experiencing tragedy? The only tragedy there is in the world is ignorance, and all evil comes from there. The only tragedy there is in the world is unwakefulness and unawareness, and from there comes fear, and from fear comes everything else. But death is not a tragedy at all. Dying is wonderful. But it's only horrible to people who have never understood life. It's only when you're afraid of life that you fear death. It's only dead people who fear death. But people who are alive have no fear of death. And one of your American authors has put it so well. The test of your awakening, I don't remember what word he uses exactly, is the depth of your belief in injustice and tragedy. What is the end of the world for a caterpillar is a butterfly for the master. Death is resurrection. But we're not talking about something that will happen, but is happening right now. If you would die to the past, if you would die to every minute, the person who is fully alive is the person who is full of death. We're always dying to things. We're always shedding everything in order to be fully alive and to be resurrected at every moment. Now, the mystics, the saints, and others, their great effort is to wake people up. If we don't wake them up, my dears, we're always going to have these other minor ills of hunger and war and violence, etc., because of the great ill, the great evil of sleeping people, ignorant people. We're always coming up with new schemes, aren't we? There's a great debate going on in India about Mother Teresa's work, because lots of people are saying, what's she doing? She's running an ambulance service for people who are being crushed by an unjust society. You know, imagine a huge factory, and people are getting crushed there, so they're taking these broken bodies and throwing them out the window, and Mother Teresa comes along with her sisters, picks up the body, puts them in an ambulance, and takes them away. We mustn't do that. We've got to change the whole system. Is that right? Yeah. Well, wait a minute. I think she's doing a great work because, all right, at least there's somebody to pick up the broken bodies. And they say, rightly perhaps, it's precisely the owners of the factories who are giving her the money to keep the lawn clean. Pick them up. Something there, something. But I wouldn't exclude her work at all. But what exactly do you plan to do now? Take over the factory, huh? Yeah. You know what's wrong with the factory? It's being run by wolves. Are you going to substitute it with another set of wolves? You think changing the system and putting wolves in charge is going to change it? In Mexico, there was a Jesuit who became the treasurer of the province. He says he wrote a note to Arupe once to ask him about the relative value of communism, socialism, and capitalism. And Father Arupe gave him a lovely reply. He said, a system is about as good or as bad as the people who use it. You know, people with golden hearts would make capitalism work beautifully. They say, look, I don't want to crush you out of the market. I'll make a little space for you so you can run your little business too or whatever. But if that doesn't change, if people haven't woken up, meaning they have not become sensitive to reality, then we have tragedy. That's the origin and the root of tragedy. Now, changing. I said to you yesterday, we're talking about people who are always wanting others to change so that they will be happy, remember? And I was saying, don't ask the world to change. You change first. Then you will get a good enough look at the world so that you will be able to change whatever you think ought to be changed. First, take the plank out of your own eye. But if you don't take it out of your eye, you have lost the right to change anyone or anything. Till you are aware of yourself, you have no right attempting to interfere with anyone else or with the world. Now, the danger of attempting to change others and to change things, if you yourself are not aware, is that you may be changing things for your own convenience, your own pride, your own dogmatic convictions and beliefs, or just to relieve your negative feelings. I happen to have negative feelings, so you'd better change so that I'll feel good. First, cope with your negative feelings, so that when you move out to change others, you're coming from love. You're not coming from hate. You're not coming from negativity. You're coming from love. And strange as it may seem, people can be very hard on others and very loving. The surgeon can be so hard on the patient and so loving. Love can be very hard indeed. What does self-change entail? I've said it in so many words again and again, but I'm going to break it down into little segments. First, insight. Not effort. Not cultivating habits, not having an ideal. Ideals do a lot of damage. You're the whole time focusing on what should be instead of understanding what is. And so you're imposing what should be on present reality, never having understood what present reality is. Now, insight. Let me give you an example of that. from my own experience, counseling experience. There's this priest who comes to me and says he's lazy. He wants to be more industrious, more active. He is lazy. And I say, lazy? What does that mean? Now we're going to get into awareness, into insight. What's he talking about? In the old days, I would have said to him, oh, you're lazy, huh? He says, yes. Well, let's see. Why don't you do this? Why don't you make a list of things you want to do every day? And then every night you tick them off. That'll give you a good feeling. And then, so build up a habit. Or I might say to him, who's your ideal? Who's your patron saint? He says, Saint Francis Xavier. Now see how much that guy worked? You got to meditate on your ideal, and that will get you moving, etc. Now that's one way of going about it, but I'm sorry to say, it's superficial. Making him use his willpower, his effort, etc., doesn't last very long. His behavior may change, but he does not. Let's move in the other direction. I say to him, lazy? What's that? You know, there are about 500 million types of laziness. Let's hear what your type of laziness. Would you describe what you mean when you're talking about laziness? He says, well, you know, I never get anything done. Uh-huh. You don't feel like doing anything. That's right, I don't feel like doing anything. You mean right from the moment you get up in the morning? Yes. He says, you know, I wake up in the morning and nothing worth getting up for. He says, that's right. Nothing worth getting up for. You're depressed. He says, you could call it that. I'm depressed. So I've sort of withdrawn. Have you always been like this? Well, not always. When I was younger, I was more active. When I was in the seminary, I was full of life. When did this begin? Oh, about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. Anything happen? He's thinking. So, well, if you have to think so much, nothing special could have happened 4 years ago. How about the year before that? What happened? He said, well, I was ordained. Anything happened in your ordination year? No, well, there was a little thing, the final examination in theology, you know, I failed and was a bit of a disappointment, but I've gotten over it, it's all right. What happened? He says, well, the bishop was planning to send me to Rome to eventually teach in the seminary and... Well, I rather like the idea, but since I failed in the examination, he changed his mind. He sent me to this parish. He said, actually, that was an injustice, because the man on the board, he was... Oh, he's getting worked up now. There's anger there. He hasn't gotten over it. We've got to work through that. He's disappointed. It's useless preaching him a sermon. We've got to find out what's happening there. It's useless giving him an ideal. We've got to get him to face his anger, his disappointment, to get some insight into all of that. When he's able to work through that, he's back into life again. If I had only given him an exhortation, if I had said, do you have married brothers and sisters? I do. Do you see how hard they have to work? And you know the trouble with us clergy? We have everything found for, you know, we get our meals. That'll make him guilty. But he hasn't got self-insight, which is going to heal him. So that's the first thing, the marvels of psychological insight. Now, there's a great boon in psychology, great help. Modern psychology is indeed a great help to understand how our emotions keep tying us into all kinds of situations. Not really necessary. It isn't too difficult to unearth his addiction, his attachment. There's another great help, understanding. Did you really think this was going to make you happy? You just assumed it was going to make you happy. Why did you want to teach in the seminary? Because you wanted to be happy. You thought that being a professor, having a certain status and prestige, would make you happy. Would it? Understanding is called for there. Or the other thing that I told you the other day, when I made the distinction between I and me. There's a great help too. Disidentify what's going on. after we unearth what's causing your depression, that's not difficult to see at all. Meditating and imitating externally the behavior of Jesus is no help. It's not a question of imitating Christ. It is a question of becoming what Jesus was. It's a question of becoming Christ, becoming aware, understanding what's going on within you. You know, all the other methods we use for self-change could be compared to pushing a car. Let's suppose you have to go from here to, what shall we say, to Syracuse. I have to go from here to Syracuse. The car breaks down somewhere. Say, well, too bad, the car's broken down, we roll up our sleeves and begin to push the car. And we push and we push and we push and we push till we get to Syracuse. Say, well, we made it. Where do we go next? St. Louis. Oh, God, St. Louis. So we roll up our sleeves and push it all the way to St. Louis. You say, hey, you're making a mess of your life. Yes, but we got there, didn't we? But you call this life? You know what you need? You need an expert. You need a mechanic. Lift the hood. Say, hey, you got to change your spark plug. That's what we do. Turn the ignition key and the car's moving. You need the expert. You need understanding. You need insight. You need awareness. You don't need pushing. You don't need effort. That's why people are so tired. People are so weary. This afternoon, I'll tell you the root of the whole thing. You were trained, and I was trained, to be dissatisfied with ourselves. That's where the thing is. That's where the evil comes from psychologically. We're always dissatisfied. We're always discontent. We're always pushing. So go on, make more efforts. More and more efforts. There's always that conflict inside. But there's very little understanding. I told you about those red letter days in my life. One of them was in Chicago. One was in Spain. And the third one was in India. It was a great day, really. It was the day after I was ordained. And I sat in a confessional. We had a very saintly Jesuit priest in our parish, a Spaniard, Spanish priest. I remember the day I went to the novitiate. I thought I'd better make a clean breast of everything and, you know, confess everything. So when I go to the novitiate, I'll be nice and clean. And I won't have to tell the novice master anything, all right? And old Soler, you know, he'd have crowds of people outside his, lining up his confessional, because he'd have a violet curtain, and I don't know where he got this, a violet-colored handkerchief, which he'd cover his eyes with, and he'd just mumble something and give you a penance and send you away. And he'd only met me a couple of times, you know, once. He'd call me Anthony, so all right. So he met me, and I thought I'd go to Soler. I stood in line. When my turn came, I changed my voice. And I said, it's, you know, quite a while since I've been to confession. He listened to me patiently, and he gave me my penance, and he gave me the absolution, and he said, Anthony, when are you... Oh, God. When are you going to the novitiate? Oh. Well, I went to this place the day after my ordination. He said, do you want to hear confessions? I said, yeah, all right. So he said, go and sit in my confessional. I thought, my, the holy man, I'm going to sit in his confessional. I heard confessions for 3 hours. It was Palm Sunday. We had the Easter crowd coming in. I came out depressed. Not at what I had heard, because I'd been led to expect that. And having some inkling of what was going on in my own heart, I was shocked by nothing. You know what depressed me? The realization that I'd give them that little pious advice, now pray to the Blessed Mother, she loves you, and remember that God is on your side. But what was I saying? Were these pious platitudes any cure for cancer, really? And this is cancer I'm dealing with. And I swore a mighty oath to myself that day, I'll learn, so that it would not be said of me, Father, what you said was absolutely true and totally useless. Awareness. Insight. Because when you get the expert, when you become an expert, You'll soon become an expert. You don't need to take a course in psychology, you know. As you begin to observe yourself, to watch yourself, to pick up those negative feelings, you'll find your own way of explaining it. And you'll notice the change. But then you'll have to deal with a big villain. And that villain is self-condemnation, self-hatred, self-dissatisfaction. Let's continue with change through awareness. Effortlessness in change. I thought of a nice image for that. The sailboat. You have a sailboat with a mighty wind in its sails, and it glides along so effortlessly. And the boatman, what does he have to do? Nothing but steer. He makes no effort. He doesn't push the boat. That's something of an image of what happens when change comes about through awareness, through understanding. Plenty of quotes today. I was going through some of my notes this afternoon, and I found some quotes that fit pretty well with what I've been saying this morning, so I thought I'd read them to you. Listen to this one. There is nothing so cruel as nature. In the whole universe, there is no escape from it. And yet, it is not nature that does the injury, but the person's own heart. Does that make sense? It isn't nature that does the injury, but the person's own heart. You know the story of Paddy who fell from the scaffolding and got a good bump? He was working on that building. And they said, did the fall hurt you, Paddy? And Paddy says, no, it was the stop that hurt, not the fall. When you cut water, the water doesn't get hurt. When you cut something that's solid, it breaks. You got solid attitudes inside. You've got solid illusions inside. That's what bumps against nature. That's where you get hurt. That's where the pain comes. Beginning to make sense? My, I've been talking about nothing else these days. You pick up your addictions. You pick up your illusions. You identify yourself with the me. You're going to get hurt. You're going to experience pain. So that's where it comes from. How come you experience so much pain in this situation, someone else doesn't? Same situation, different heart, different outlook, different attitude. Change your attitude. Something will happen. And here's a lovely one. These are mostly from Oriental sages. Don't even remember from whom. It really doesn't matter. Like in the Bible, the author doesn't matter. What is said is what matters. If the eye is unobstructed, the result is sight. If the ear is unobstructed, the result is hearing. If the nose is unobstructed, the result is a sense of smell. If the mouth is unobstructed, the result is a sense of taste. If the mind is unobstructed, the result is wisdom. When you drop those barriers that you have erected through your concepts and conditionings, wisdom is not something acquired. Wisdom is not experience. Wisdom comes from not being influenced by experience. Wisdom is not applying yesterday's solution to today's problem. As somebody said to me when I was doing my degree in psychology in Chicago years ago, someone said, frequently in the life of a priest, 50 years experience is 1 year's experience repeated 50 times. You got the same solutions. This is the way to deal with the alcoholic. This is the way to deal with priests. This is the way to deal with sisters. This is the way to deal with the divorcee. That isn't wisdom. Wisdom is to be sensitive to this situation, to this person, uninfluenced by any carryover from the past. No residue from the experience of the past. Quite unlike what most people are accustomed to thinking. I would add another sentence to the ones I've read. When the heart is unobstructed, the result is love. Now, I've been talking a great deal about love these days, and I told you there's nothing that can be said really about love. We can only speak of non-love and drop that. We can only speak of addictions and drop that. But of love itself, nothing may be said explicitly. How would I describe that? You know what I decided to do? I hope it'll go down well with you. I decided to give you one of those meditations I'm writing in a new book of mine, one of those reflections. I'll read it to you slowly, and you meditate on it as we go along, because I've got it put down rather pithily there, and I could get that done in 3 or 4 minutes. Otherwise, it would take me half an hour. Let's try it out, shall we? Okay. It's a comment on a gospel sentence. And the sentence is, most of these reflections I've written in this book deal with gospel reflections. I was just thinking this morning of another nice reflection. This one comes from Plato, by the way. One cannot make a slave of a free person. For a free person is free even in prison. Or rather, one cannot make a slave of a wise person. Does that ring a bell? If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go 2. You think you've made a slave out of me, putting a load on my back? You haven't. Exactly what I was talking about all of these days. You're trying to change exterior reality. My dear, if you need to be out of prison in order to be free, you are a prisoner indeed. Freedom is not in exterior circumstances. Freedom resides in the heart. And when you have attained wisdom, who can enslave you? And you're out of prison and enslaved by your addictions and your attachments and your conditionings and your negative emotions. You call yourself free? Aha, there it is. Now listen to this gospel sentence. He sent the people away. After doing that, he went up to the mountain to pray alone. It grew late, and he was there all by himself. That's what love is all about. Has it ever occurred to you that you can only love when you are alone? What does it mean to love? It means to see a person, a thing, a situation as it really is and not as you imagine it to be. And to give it the response that it deserves. You can hardly be said to love what you do not even see. And what prevents us from seeing? Our conditioning, our concepts, our categories, our prejudices, our projections, the labels that we have drawn from our culture and from our past experiences. Seeing is the most arduous thing that a human being can undertake, for it calls for a disciplined, alert mind. Remember what I said to you this morning? Am I really seeing this person, or am I coming from my conditioning or from my prejudiced view? It calls for an alert mind. But most people would much rather lapse into mental laziness than take the trouble to see each person, each thing in present moment freshness. Let's stop there now and ask, is that clear? Or isn't it? To see, that's the least we could demand of love. See me, as someone said once, I'll always remember the false image that I had of you. I will always love the false image that I had of you. Am I loving the image or am I loving this person? Am I projecting something from the past onto this person? Very well. To drop your conditioning in order to see is arduous enough. But seeing calls for something that is more painful still. The dropping of the control which society exercises over you. A control whose tentacles have penetrated to the very roots of your being. So that to remove it is like tearing yourself apart. What is this control? If you wish to understand this, think of a little child that is given a taste for drugs. As the drugs penetrate the body of the child, it becomes addicted, and its whole being cries out for the drug. To be without the drug is so unbearable a torment that it seems preferable to die. Think of that image. The body has got addicted to the drug. Now, this is exactly what your society did to you when you were born. You were not allowed to enjoy the solid, nutritious food of life, namely, work, play, fun, laughter, the company of people, the pleasures of the senses and the mind. You were given a taste for the drug called approval. Appreciation. Attention. You know, to the point where psychologists began to tell us that a child needs attention. You've got to give him plenty of attention after you've drugged the child. Yes. I'll be quoting a great, great man after a while. A man called Neil. Those of you in education have surely heard of him. A.S. Neil, the author of Summerhill. Remind me to recommend two books to you tonight. I'll write them on the board. I'm only going to recommend two. And one of them is going to be Summerhill. Neil. Neil says, the sign of a sick child is that it is always hovering around its parents. It is interested in persons. The healthy child has no interest in persons. It is interested in things. You know, when the child is sure of mother's love, it forgets mother. It's going out to explore the world. It's curious. Looking for a frog to put into its mouth, kind of thing. When he's hovering around mother, bad sign. He's insecure. Maybe mother has been trying to suck love out of the child and not given the child all the freedom and assurance it wanted. Mother's always been threatening to go away in many subtle ways. All right, so we were given a taste for the drug called addiction, approval, attention. The drug called success. You've got to make it to the top. Prestige, get your name in the papers. Power, be the boss. That's a success story. People take orders from you. We were given a taste for this. Be the captain of the team. Lead the band. Having got a taste for these drugs, you became addicted and began to dread their loss. So the control. You felt terror at the prospect of failure, of making mistakes, the prospect of criticism from others. So you became cravenly dependent on people and you lost your freedom. Others now have the power to make you happy or miserable. You're craving for your drug. And much as you hate the suffering that this involves, you find yourself completely helpless. There is never a minute when consciously or unconsciously you are not aware of, you're not attuned to the reaction of others marching to the beat of their drums. A nice definition of an awakened person is that this person no longer marches to the drums of society. This person dances to the tune of the music that springs up from within. When you are ignored or disapproved of, you experience a loneliness so unbearable that you crawl back to people to beg for the comforting drug called support, encouragement, reassurance. To live with people in this state involves a never-ending tension. Have you ever paused to think of that? Living with people is tension. Sartre, hell is the other. How true when you are in this state of dependence, but how true? You've always got to be on your best behavior. You can never let your hair down. You've got to live up to expectations. You're always tense. To be with people is to live in tension. To be without them brings the agony of loneliness. You miss them. You have lost your capacity to see them exactly as they are and to respond to them accurately because your perception of them is clouded by the need to get your drug. You see them in as much as they are a support for getting your drug or a threat to having your drug removed. You're always looking at people, consciously or unconsciously, through these eyes. Will I get what I want from them? Will I not get what I want from them? And if they can neither support nor threaten my drug, I'm not interested in them. That's a horrible thing to say, but my dear friends, I wonder if there's anyone in this room of whom this cannot be said. If we really dropped our illusions, inasmuch as they can give me what I want or deprive me of what I want, I'm interested. I'm alert. Otherwise, not much interest or no interest at all. The consequence of this is terrifying and inescapable. You have lost your capacity to love. You need awareness and you need nourishment. You need good, healthy nourishment. Learn to enjoy the solid food of life. Good food, that too. Good wine, good water, taste. Lose your mind and come to your senses. That's good, healthy nourishment. The pleasures of the senses and the pleasures of the mind. Good reading, when you enjoy a good book or a real good discussion. Thinking, marvelous. See, unfortunately, people have gone crazy and they're getting more and more addicted because they do not know how to enjoy the lovely things of life. So they're going in for greater and greater artificial stimulants. Some years ago, President Carter, during the oil crisis, made an appeal to Americans everywhere to go in for austerity. I thought to myself, he shouldn't tell them to be austere. He should tell them to really enjoy things. Most of them have lost their capacity for enjoyment. I really do believe that most people have in affluent countries. They got to have more and more expensive gadgets. They can't enjoy the simple things of life. And then I walk into all kinds of places where they have all the most marvelous music. You know, you get these records at a discount or whatever, and they're all stacked there. I never hear anybody listening to them. No time, no time, no time, no time. They're guilty. No time to enjoy life. They're overworked. Go, 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 go. If you really enjoyed life and the simple pleasures of the senses, you would be amazed. You'd develop that extraordinary discipline of the animals. An animal will never overeat. Left in its natural habitat, it will never be overweight. It will never drink or eat anything that is not good for its health. Never. You'll never touch it. You'll never find an animal smoking. It always exercises as much as it needs. Look at your cat after it's had its little breakfast. Look how it relaxes. And see how it springs into action. Look at the suppleness of its limbs and the aliveness of its body. We've lost that. We got lost in our minds and our ideas and our ideals and so on. And it's always go, go, go. And we've got an inner self-conflict which the animals don't have. And we're always condemning ourselves and making ourselves guilty. You know what I'm talking about? Because I could have said of myself what one Jesuit friend said to me some years ago. Take that plate of sweets away, because in front of a plate of sweets or chocolates, I lose my freedom, he said. And that was true of me too. I lost my freedom in front of all kinds of things. No more, no more. I'm satisfied with very little, and I enjoy it intensely. When you've enjoyed it intensely, you need very little. But you've lost your capacity for enjoyment. You're never there. It's like people who are busy planning their vacation, and they spend months planning it. They get to the spot, and then they're all anxious about their reservations for flying back. But they're taking pictures, all right. And later, they'll show you pictures in an album of places that they never saw, but that they photographed. That's a symbol of modern life. So I cannot insist enough on this kind of asceticism. Slow down and taste and smell and hear and let your senses come alive. You want a royal road to mysticism? Sit down quietly and listen to all the sounds around you, so that as far as possible, no sound is excluded. You do not necessarily focus on any sound, but you hear them all. Oh, you will see the miracles that happen to you if you are able to do this. When your senses come unclogged. So that is extremely important for the process of change. That with awareness, as I've explained to you all of today. Before the end of the session, I do want to give you a taste of the difference between analysis and awareness, or information on the one hand and insight on the other. Information is not insight. Analysis is not awareness. Knowledge is not awareness. Suppose I walked in here and there was a snake crawling up my arm, and I say to you, do you see the snake crawling up my arm? I've just checked in an encyclopedia, you know, the Encyclopedia Britannica before coming into the session, and I find that this snake is known as a Russell's viper. If it bit me, I would die inside of half a minute. Would you kindly suggest ways and means by which I could get rid of this creature that's crawling up my arm? Who talks like this? I got the information, but I got no awareness. I'm destroying myself through alcohol. Would you kindly suggest ways and means I could get rid of this? This guy got no awareness. He knows he's destroying himself. He's not aware of it. If he were aware of it, it would drop that minute. If I were aware of what this thing was, I wouldn't brush it off my arm. It would get brushed off through me. That's what I'm talking about. That's the change I'm talking about. You don't change yourself. It's not me changing me. Change takes place through you in you. That's about the most adequate way I can express it. You see change take place in you, through you, in your awareness. It happens. You don't do it. When you're doing it, bad sign. Won't last. And if it does, God have mercy on the people you're living with, because you're going to be very rigid, you know. These people who are converted on the basis of self-hatred and self-dissatisfaction, boy, they're impossible to live with. Somebody said, you want to be a martyr? Marry a saint. So God have mercy on all of us if you, that the change lasts. Because you're so rigid on yourself, you're going to be rigid on everyone else. But in awareness, you keep your softness, your suppleness, your gentleness, your openness, your flexibility. And you don't push. Change occurs. Remember an alcoholic priest telling us in Chicago when I was studying my psychology there, he said, you know, I had all the information and I knew that the alcohol was killing me. And believe me, nothing changes an alcoholic, not the love of his wife or the love of his kids. And he does love them, but it doesn't change him. But he said, I discovered one thing that changed me. I was lying in a gutter one day. There was a slight drizzle. I was in the bad books of the Archbishop again. We had been friends before. Not too friendly now anymore. But all of that did not affect me. But he said, in that moment, I opened my eyes and I saw that this was killing me. But I saw it. I've never had the desire to touch a drop after that. He said, as a matter of fact, I've even drunk a bit after that, but never more than I needed, or never more, never enough to damage me. I couldn't do it. I just cannot do it. I've seen. I've been aware. That's what I'm talking about. Awareness. Not information. Awareness. A friend of mine who was given to excessive smoking said, you know, he had all kinds of little jokes. He'd say, oh, come on, they tell us that tobacco kills people. Look at the ancient Egyptians. They're all dead and none of them smoked. They're all dead. So that kind of thing. Well, one day he was having trouble with his lungs. He went to our Cancer Research Institute in Bombay, which is pretty well equipped. He went there and the doctor said, Father, you've got two patches on your lungs. It could be cancer. You'll have to come back next month. You know, he never touched a cigarette after that. He knew it could kill him before. Now he was aware that it could kill him. That's the difference. The founder of my religious order, St. Ignatius, has a nice expression for that. He says, he calls it tasting and feeling the truth. Not knowing it, but tasting and feeling it. Getting a feel for it. When you get a feel for it, you change. When you know it in your head, you don't. Listen to this, for instance. Just give you a couple of examples more and then we'll end. I've often said to people, the way to really live, but to really live, is to die. Or, the passport for living is to imagine that you're in your grave. Can you imagine that? You're lying in your coffin. Any posture you like, nice. In India, we put them cross-legged. What do you know? You know when they're dead? Oh, yes, and they're sometimes carried that way to the burning ground. Sometimes they're lying flat and so on. All right. So imagine you're lying flat and your hands are there and one over the other and you're dead. Look at your problem from that viewpoint now. Come on. Look at it. Changes everything, doesn't it? Sure does. Or as someone says, you know, it really bothers me that after 100 million years, no one except a handful will probably remember me, says this guy. What does he think he is after 100 million years? But anyway, now, the coffin. What a lovely, lovely meditation. Do it every day if you have the time, huh? You'll come alive. It's unbelievable. You know, I've got a meditation about that in that book of mine, Wellsprings, where you see the body decomposing, then you've got bones, then you've got dust. And you know, every time I talk about this, I have people say, "Ooh, ha, what's so disgusting about it? This is reality, for heaven's sake." See, I told you, you don't want to see reality. Who conditioned you? You don't want to think of death. You people don't live, most of you, you don't live. You're just keeping the body alive. That's not life. You're not living until it doesn't matter a tinker's damn whether you live or you die. Now you live. Only when you're ready to lose your life, you live it. When you're protecting your life, you're dead. You're sitting up there in an attic, and I say to you, "Come on out." You say, "No, no, 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 no." You know, if you die, I read about people going down the stairs and they slip and they break their necks. That's too dangerous. And I can't get you to cross the street because, say, do you know how many people get run over when they're crossing a street? And if I can't get you to cross a street, how could I get you to cross continents? And if I can't get you to peep out of your little narrow beliefs and convictions and take a look at another world, you're dead. You're completely dead. Life has passed you by. You sat in your little prison. You're scared. You're frightened. You're frightened you lose your God. You lose your religion. You lose your friends. You lose your health. You lose all kinds of things. Life is for the gambler. It really is. That's what Jesus was saying. You're ready to risk it. And you know when you're ready to risk it? When you found it. When you know that this thing that people call life is not really life. You found something else. When you have seen something else, and it doesn't matter whether you live or die. Everywhere I go, it seems to matter so much to keep people in a state, in a vegetable state. You know, it's like when the body perishes, life disappears. So people frequently mistake keeping the body alive with living. It's not the same as living. Now, love the thought of death. Love it. Go back to it again and again. Think of the loveliness of that corpse, of that skeleton, of those bones crumbling till you got a handful of dust. Huh? Huh? And from there now, look at your life. What a relief. What a relief. Most of you probably don't even know what I'm talking about. You're too frightened to think of it. Probably. But it's such a relief, you know, when you can look back on life from that perspective. What about all those mighty problems? Or visit a graveyard. It's an enormously purifying and beautiful experience. You walk there. Why are you so frightened of reality? Huh? Huh? And you look at this man and say, "Gee, he lived so many years ago. 2 centuries ago. Must have had all the problems that I have. He must have had lots of sleepless nights. Over stupidities like me." How crazy. We live for such a short time. And then, as that Italian poet says, we live in a flash of light. And evening comes and it is night forever. It's only a flash. And we waste it. We waste it with our anxieties and our worries and our concerns and our burdens. Now, if you make that meditation, you may just end up with information. Or you may end up with awareness. And in that moment of awareness, you're new. At least as long as it lasts. Then you'll know the difference between information and awareness. Am I talking sense? All right, you're getting it. You're on. Very good. Or listen to this. A friend of mine, just 10 days ago in India, who's an astronomer, was giving me some of the most fundamental things in astronomy. It's mind-boggling. You know, I did not know till he told me that when you see the sun, you're seeing it where it was 8.5 minutes ago, not where it is now. Because it takes the ray of the sun and 8.5 minutes to get to us. So you're not seeing it where it is, it's somewhere else. You're seeing it where it was 8.5 minutes ago. And stars, the ray of light comes from the sun in 8.5 minutes. Stars have been sending light to us for hundreds of thousands of years. So when we're looking at them, they may not even be there when we're looking at them. They're somewhere else. We're getting the light now. Now, he said, imagine a galaxy, a whole universe, and this Earth of ours lost towards the tail end of the galaxy, the Milky Way. It's not even in the center. Somewhere at the tail end. Every one of those stars is a sun. Some suns are so big that you could put the sun and the earth and the distance between them in one of them. They've got planets, possibly, but we don't know because the planets don't send light. Possibly there's life on those planets. We have no means of knowing because there's no light coming from them. The planets are in darkness. Well, after discovering all of this about 50 years ago, they found there was yet another universe, another galaxy. You know how many universes they calculate there are, or how many galaxies they calculate there are today? A sober estimate says 100 million galaxies. And the universe as we know it is expanding at the rate of the diameter. Is that the word I want? Yes, not the radius, the diameter is expanding at the rate of 2 million miles a second. Imagine a bubble that you're blowing and the universe is expanding at the rate of 2 million miles a second. You know, I was having dinner with this guy and it was fascinating listening to all of this. And I come out of that restaurant and move into the street and look up there and I have a different feel, a different perspective. That's awareness. You could pick this up as cold facts, and that's information. Or you suddenly get another perspective on life. What are we? What's this universe? What's human life? Now, when you get that feel, that's what I'm talking about when I talk of awareness. Now, as you begin to practice some of the exercises I've been giving you, you will get this feel in many things. Then you will know. Then you will know.